From the Sky News Centre at 6, former English Defence League leader Tommy Robinson has been found in contempt of court for live streaming video of defendants in a criminal trial on Facebook. Two High Court judges agreed with an earlier ruling that the broadcasting broke reporting restrictions as jurors were still considering their verdicts. Legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg says the court did not accept Mr. Robinson's defence.
Citizen journalists are subject to the law in just the same way as those of us who make our living through broadcasting and commentating about the law. Ignorance of the law is no defence, and you have to comply with court orders.
Eight ringleaders behind the UK's largest ever modern slavery gang have been jailed for between 3 and 11 years. They lured more than 400 Polish victims to Britain, only to force them to work long days in the West Midlands with little pay. A man's been arrested after a van struck a group of people queuing outside a food bank in Derbyshire. Four people were hurt in the crash this morning in the village of Kirkhallam. The Unite unions describe Jaguar Land Rover's plan to build electric cars in Birmingham as a fantastic boost for the industry. They'll be made at its Castle Bromwich site, with batteries and motors coming from other factories in the West Midlands. That's the latest. I'm Kit Bradshaw.
This is Bristol. Yes, it's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, the other Fabian, the modern-day John Dee, behind our brave Royal Marine pirates who took over an unarmed Iranian oil tanker yesterday morning off Gibraltar. He's Fabian Picardo, and he's the Chief Minister of Gibraltar. Very few people have heard of him before, but we hear what he's got to do about what he's doing about yesterday's Iranian tanker seizure. What he's got to say about it, even. And it's taking place right now, in about an hour's time, in Tony Benn House on Victoria Street. Three Latin American ambassadors to the UK are explaining how the US is casting a shadow on their countries. The meeting's called Trump, Targeting the Latin American Left, and it's been organised by Bristol Link with Nicaragua. If you've got the inclination, you can get down there now before it starts. Plus an exclusive on the apparent air raid on a Libyan detention camp. Khalifa Haftar commands the Libyan National Army. He's been blamed in the Western media. But was it the official NATO-backed government of Sirraj? Or even the very powerful and mysterious third force in the country, which we'll be hearing about later. And Alex Craner, author of the book on the Magnitsky Act, talks about Russia in 1990 when perestroika turned to economic disaster and companies could only pay their staff in goods. Who were the Russian oligarchs buying up Russia's infrastructure for virtually nothing at the time? And how does the Magnitsky Act relate to all of this? Putin is trying to get some of that wealth back. Don't hold your breath, Vladimir. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 14 and dry. Highs this weekend around 22, a mainly cloudy weekend, but a few little bits of sun for St Paul's Carnival. Next week, highs of 22 Celsius, mainly cloudy with a few light showers. Next weekend, 13th and 14th of July, highs around 24 Celsius, hotter, mainly sunny though. Better weekend next weekend with some showers, a few showers too though. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. Hi Fabian, welcome to the Politics Show.
Nice to be here again.
Can you just give us your take on, it's one of the things we're going to be looking at now, is the Conservative leadership contest. There was a big focus on Labour for a long time with Owen Smith and his rivalry with Jeremy Corbyn, but now all the focus is on the Conservative Party. Is there really anything to choose between these two candidates from your point of view? I mean, obviously you're not voting in this, but will it make any difference at all, do you think?
I personally am more worried worried about Boris simply because he made such a mess of things in London, and he's, you know, you think about the Nazanin Radcliffe case where, you know, an innocent woman is rotting in jail because of a gaffe by someone who now wants to be the Prime Minister. That, and, you know, he's not even sorry, he's not even bothered about it, and that, somebody with those kind of attitudes and those kind of values worries me a lot.
Well, I thought one of the best people, we did a whole load of stuff about Jeremy Hunt last week, looking at his family connections. I mean, one of the things that shocked me about that, Fabian, really, was to find out that it was his cousin, Virginia Bottomley, who was a previous health secretary. She's now chair of Nuffield Health, one of these private healthcare firms.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. This is what the Tories do. They look after themselves. They don't really... You know, the whole Brexit thing was all about settling divisions within the Conservative Party. Whatever happened to the country didn't really matter. And so it continues. This is all about the Conservatives are only interested in who's, you know, going to sort of get them out of the mess they're now in. They don't, or they think might get them out of the mess they're now in. They don't actually care about the impact on the country or the impact on ordinary people.
Well, I was interested to see, because Mayor Ken Livingstone, Labour, was, I mean, I think he was Labour Mayor.
He was Labour.
Martin, he wasn't actually elected as a Labour politician, was he? The Labour Party put forward Frank Dobson to stand. Isn't that right?
In the first place, the Labour Party won the election to the GLC, but he wasn't the Labour leader. And there was then an internal coup within the Labour group, which made him Labour leader. And that's how he first came to be prominent in London politics. And of course, at that stage, there was no directly elected mayor of London. There was just the Greater London Council, and he was just the leader of the council. And that was actually his most radical phase, actually.
So what about, what about more recently? I think it was around 2002 wasn't Dobson put forward
That's exactly right. And Livingstone was independent.
That's right, Livingstone was an independent.
And then second time around, he ran as Labour.
Yeah, so because he won and he beat Frank Dobson, he was one of the few people who's been pushed out of the Labour Party.
Well, why is the Labour
and stood
Party,
against the Labour
why
Party?
Why is the Labour
from the
Party
left?
So hostile to Ken Livingstone?
Well, because basically he wasn't a Blairite, and there's always been tension.
Well, this is the Blair era. You're right.
There was always tension about that.
Anyway, I was fascinated to know what Ken made, because he had two terms as Mayor of London, and then Boris took over. What Ken Livingstone made, and I tracked him down earlier this week, and so we've got quite an extended interview now with Ken Livingstone talking about not just Boris, but lots of other things besides, including managing a big city.
I'm Ken Livingstone. I was the first mayor of London back in 2000. But when I was a kid, my interest was natural history and astronomy. If you'd said you're going to be a politician, I'd laughed in your face. It was the night Kennedy was assassinated back in 63. I was 18. And so over that weekend, we all gripped to the television and all this stuff about American politics and so on. So I started reading about American politics and then on to British politics. By the end of the 60s, I just realised that if you want to make society better, there's no point waiting for revolution. You've got to get involved and do things.
Or waiting for anyone else to actually do it for you. I mean, this is what we do, isn't it? Every, whatever, four or five years, we vote and we hope that whoever we vote for is going to do what we want.
Yeah, and invariably people are disappointed. And it's getting worse, because when I came into politics in the late 60s, and I followed John Major onto the council, who went on to become a Tory Prime Minister, both the Labour and Tory politicians were there to do things. How can we make a better life and things like that? Now it feels like they just all want to be a celebrity, to be famous. I look at Boris Johnson, I think, you should have gone into show business, because he was Mayor of London for 8 years. He virtually did nothing except promote himself.
But Ken, you were talking about Adolf Hitler supporting Zionism. That really is putting your foot in it, isn't it?
No, it simply states a historical fact. I mean, it's no different from saying we were invaded by the Normans back in 1066. And I mean, what was interesting, in the couple of weeks after that row erupted, somewhere between 30 and 40 Jewish men and women stopped me on the street to say, what's all this about? We know what you said is true. I mean, the Jewish community know. Back in July 1933, the German Zionists agreed to deal with Hitler's government, and over the next 5 years, they cooperated in moving 60,000 of Germany's Jews to live in Palestine.
But cooperating is not the same as supporting, is it? I mean, at the moment, Trump is cooperating with Kim Jong-un. Only thing is, he doesn't actually support him.
Well, I mean, support...
It's called diplomacy.
No, support doesn't mean to say you like someone. The Nazis had 600,000 Germans who were Jewish, and they wanted them out. And the German Zionists wanted, you know, Jews to go back to the traditional homeland of Palestine. So they worked together over the 6 years. It wasn't just an agreement to move. The Germans then agreed to sell Mauser pistols to the underground Jewish army and so on. And then in 1938, when the British government banned any more Jews from going to Palestine, the Gestapo cooperated with the German Zionists to smuggle them in on boats leaving Hamburg. So there was absolute solid support. And if you look at the historian who has studied this, Francis Nicosia, he's the professor of Holocaust studies at the University of Vermont, and he's been researching and writing about this for 40 years, and he says there was overwhelming support, that's the word he uses, in both the Nazi government and the Nazi party for the German Zionists.
If that's true, why didn't you stick to your guns? Why did you give up on your struggle to stay in the Labour Party?
Because basically the machine, the bureaucracy, is still filled with people appointed by Blair under New Labour. And they dragged this out for 2 years as a way of undermining Jeremy. And I just thought it's ridiculous to have all this going on. I mean, when I lost the mayoral election to Boris Johnson in 2012, I was just about to be 67. My wife had gone off to get a degree and become a teacher, so I became the house husband. I mean, I basically retired, you know, back in 2012.
And hung up your principles on the back of the door?
No. I mean, I was involved in doing speeches and supporting campaigns, environmental stuff and so on. But, you know, I never expected to run for office again. Mind you, you look now and you've got Bernie Sanders at the age of 77 might become president.
And Jeremy's knocking on a bit.
He's only 70, but he's also much fitter than me. I mean, he's always had a much more healthy diet, and I never saw him getting drunk in the bars at the House of Commons.
Actually, a little bit of alcohol apparently can be healthy for you, particularly a drop of red wine. What do you make of all these claims over the last couple of weeks about his health? It's no getting away from the fact that he is very old now.
Oh, it's nonsense. I mean, I have never seen anybody else at the age of 72 who is so fit and so active. I see. He's not just had a healthy diet. He exercises. I mean, literally. I've always been envious. I mean, I wish I could be as fit as he was. Back 50 years ago, if you'd said to me, I'm 74, I could still be working, I would have laughed at you because, you know, a 74-year-old then was hobbling around on crutches and could hardly remember their name. But my post-war generation has had the best quality of life in human history. We're now, I mean, it's not just Bernie Sanders, you've got the former vice president who's, you know, I think 78. I mean, there's a real chance the next president of America will be in the White House in their 80s. If your mind's still active and on top of it, well, that's not a problem.
What about the scandal over Chris Williamson, though? Last week we heard he's been reinstated and then suddenly unreinstated. What's going on with Chris?
Well, I said the bureaucracy is totally hostile to Jeremy. They want to get rid of him.
And isn't Jeremy responsible for appointing a lot of these people? Surely?
No. I mean, they were all put in. When Blair turned the Labour Party away from being a democratic institution to one basically run by the leadership, the disciplinary panel, I spent 11 months investigating everything I ever said or written. All the stuff about anti-Semitism was dropped. And they didn't even raise any of these issues, claiming that I said Hitler was a Zionist and Jews are like Nazis, none of that. And they just kept dragging out. They said, well, you defended the Labour MP Naz Shah, that brought the party into disrepute. I mean, it's a bit thin. And Chris Williamson, he was simply saying, and I think he defined it absolutely right, by always saying, oh yes, there is a big problem with anti-Semitism, it's just made it worse. The simple fact is, now we've finally got a decent General Secretary, she's dug into all our, and we've got over 500,000 members, and they found that about 250 have tweeted something anti-Semitic. That's 1/20 of 1% of our members.
It's not actually allegedly anti-Semitic, so some of these comments aren't actually anti-Semitic.
Well, I don't know because I've not seen them. I suspect when you look, Chris Williamson's being denounced for criticising the way we're handling a policy. That's not anti-Semitic. And very often anyone who criticises the Israeli government's mistreatment of the Palestinians is accused of being anti-Semitic. I mean, I criticise almost every government on the face of the planet. It doesn't mean to say I'm racist about that particular nation.
Didn't Chris actually accuse the Israeli embassy, though, of being one of the forces behind the anti-Semitism scandal in the Labour Party, which is actually a scandal brought about by Labour members?
No. I mean, the simple fact is, I can remember being at the Labour Party conference, it was 1981 or 1982, and for the first time we're having a debate about whether or not we should recognise Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organisation. And I remember seeing Israeli embassy officials lobbying trade union bosses to cast their block vote one way or the other. That's what embassies do. They're not there just, you know, to look out the window and think it's nice out there. They're always interfering in the politics of the country they're based in. Our embassies do that, America's do, they all do. And by stirring up this anti-Semitism stuff, it means people are much less likely to criticise the Israeli government's treatment of the Palestinians. The embassies are not covered by our laws. They're a tiny little part of their home country. I mean, we don't even have the right for police to enter the embassy or anything like that. The simple fact is that's what embassies do. All through our history, embassies have been spying or undermining people they don't like. Their job is to promote the interests of the country they represent.
Okay, so what is this anti-Semitism scandal of the Labour Party really all about then?
I joined the Labour Party 50 years ago. In all my time in the party, I never heard anyone say anything anti-Semitic. And when this row erupted 3 years ago, 80 Labour Party Jewish members published a letter in The Guardian saying in their hundreds of years in the party, none of them had ever heard or seen anything.
Doesn't that depend on how you define anti-Semitism? Some people would be offended by something, no?
No, it doesn't. I mean, literally, very often when I was an MP and we'd had a late night session, a Jewish MP would drive me home because he lives not far from here. He's dead now. In all those endless hours in the car, he never once raised any issue of anti-Semitism. I can't ever recall any Jewish Labour MP in my lifetime raising the issue that there's a problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, because if you're anti-Semitic, you won't go join the Labour Party because all the most prominent Jewish MPs are on the Labour benches. If you're racist, you're not going to join the Labour Party. I mean, I can remember one in my entire 50 years in the party, one racist comment back in 1970 when a white member in my local Labour Party complained that black people shouldn't be writing songs like Young, Gifted and Black. That's it in 50 years.
What about people that accuse you? You've mentioned the Palestinians there of having far too much to do with these terrorists, supporting the IRA, supporting Hamas, these kinds of groups.
Well, look, I've not just been accused of being anti-Semitic, I've accused of being corrupt, alcoholic, violent, tax-dodging. The day I became the leader of the Greater London Council back in 1981, Thatcher made a speech saying my plan was to impose on Britain a communist tyranny like those of Eastern Europe. Suggesting that cut and bust and tube fares would spark a commie revolution was nonsense, but up until that moment, no GLC leader had ever been a national political figure. We didn't have a press officer. You were never in the national press. And every few weeks there'd be a brief mention in the London evening papers. But immediately every Tory paper allocated a reporter full-time to County Hall. The Daily Mail brought their war correspondent back from the Middle East and told him he had to file six stories a day. Immediately the press were writing articles implying I was a Soviet agent, I was supporting the IRA's bombing campaign. Private eye ran a story saying I had a secret Swiss bank account in which the Libyan dictator Gaddafi had put $200,000. And Tory Central Office was briefing the press, I'd been at a gay party in the East End of London where I'd been sodomised by six men. Now, you've got to remember, back in 1981, that wasn't the vote winner it would be today. If you're a genuine socialist, the establishment will do anything to prevent you being in power. Lies and smears are a key part of that.
What about the 1980s? As a youngster growing up in London, I can remember Fares Fair being quite amazed by it. As a school kid going to school and suddenly finding the fares to go to school were actually half what they were the previous week. What happened with that? Because you do wonder, don't you, with all this talk of congestion, we've got the same sort of problem in Bristol exactly as on a lesser scale than London has had, that actually there was potentially there a way to really rid the roads of many of the cars and get everyone onto public transport. What was the inspiration behind it and why did it sink?
I've lived all my life in London. I've never learned to drive and therefore I've always wanted good public transport. When I became the leader of the GLC, tube ridership had gone down by about 40% in the last 30 years and cutting the fares, suddenly a huge big surge of people back on. The number of cars coming into central London went down by about 10% and so on. And that was a really good thing. And then, of course, the reactionary Tory judges ruled it's illegal to cut fares, which was a real shock, created a huge campaign. But when they realised what a mistake they'd made, after about a year, I got a private contact, came to see me to say, well, if you want to cut the fares again, the judges won't rule it illegal this time. And so we cut the fares again. And so both the 5 years I was leader of the GLC and then the 8 years I was mayor of London, public transport got better. And given what we now know all this car pollution is doing to our lungs and the damage it's doing to our kids growing up in the city, I mean, I've worked for almost 50 years in the heart of London. I have the lung capacity of a man 5 years older. Now, that does real damage. But of course, back in the 60s and 70s, no one really knew about that.
When it comes to Bristol, they're now talking about imposing congestion charges. You've obviously got that here in London. You've got a diesel charge as well. If you'd been allowed to carry on with that, you wouldn't need none of these extra taxes on people.
Well, we brought in the congestion charge. It worked perfectly from day one. That was back in 2003. And then we moved on to tackling pollution. And just before I lost the election to Boris in 2008, we'd introduced a charge on heavy goods vehicles coming in to London. And if I hadn't lost to Boris, we were then going to start tackling the most polluting cars. Over that third term, we would have brought pollution down in London massively, because the first thing Boris did was cancel that. He never wanted to offend a motorist.
Is it feasible, do you think, to have free public transport? Because that's where it was heading back in the 1980s anyway.
In the 1980s, when I cut the fares, I mean, literally, getting on the tube in the rush hour, you got a seat. Now, the system is absolutely packed. It's, you know, like sardines. So making it free wouldn't be... I mean, what you've got to do is increase our public transport capacity. Now, when Crossrail opens in a year or so, that will be one big step forward. But
fingers crossed. That seems to be put off constantly.
But the simple fact is, when I became mayor 19 years ago, there were 7 million Londoners. Now we're almost at 9. And you don't just need Crossrail opening, or it's going to be called the Queen Elizabeth Line. We need another 2 or 3 of those to cope with the capacity.
So another massive change over the last 30, 40 years is house prices. It's really, really difficult for anybody to stay in London. In fact, we're now looking at sort of trainloads of people being shipped out of the city to poorer areas so that more rich people can be moved in.
Well, this is the tragedy. I mean, a third of Londoners, when they buy their first home, have to move out because they can't afford to stay here. And we're seeing an exodus. And this is all down to 40 years ago when Thatcher came to power. Up until then, Labour and Tory governments built council housing. We were building 150,000 council homes a year all over the country. And I'd been chair of housing in Camden. If we'd carried on building, we would have cleared our waiting list by 1990. She stopped building council housing, shamefully. Blair carried on with her policies, as had Cameron. And therefore, you know, the private rented sector has massively grown. And in London, the average private rent is now £17,000 a year. That's over half your take-home pay. And Jeremy Corbyn was promising this at the last election. And if we get a Labour government, we will start building council housing again.
Where would you build them? There's no space.
No, there is space. I mean, literally. I mean, when I became mayor, one of the first changes I made was to abolish all the restrictions on height and density. So you look at, I mean, the Arsenal Stadium. It's the only stadium with a concave roof. Now, that costs £5 million more because they had to put in a drainage system to stop it flooding the pitch. Why? Because Islington had a rule that nothing could ever be more than 30 metres high. We'd never have got the Shard if I hadn't abolished restrictions on height and density. You should actually judge a property development on its merit, not on these weird things. So we can get a vast amount of new housing built. We used to be building enough, so by now, if we carried on, there wouldn't be a housing problem. Everyone would have a home.
How did you get on with the City of London? Because these people really like to think they run the country.
Well, they do. I mean, under Thatcher, she deregulated the financial sector, and people swarmed in from all over the world because they could now, in London, they could do things that was illegal for them to do back in their own country. Dodgy deals, risky deals. The same was done by President Clinton. He repealed the banking restrictions in 1998. So Thatcher and Clinton, between them, lit the fuse that led to the banking crisis of 2008. You need to regulate the financial sector. I mean, in Britain, almost all the investment we do, our financial institution do, is abroad. They neglect our own economy. And so you've got to regulate the financial sector. That's why Jeremy and John McDonnell are demonised massively, because the City of London's terrified. You know, if they get in, they're going to make them pay their fair share of tax and stop all this tax dodging.
Back in the 1980s, when you'd been leader of the Greater London Council, Margaret Thatcher abolished it.
It was a tragedy, because we then had 14 years in which London was the only major city in the world without an administration. So by the time I became mayor, I mean, I remember the business community saying to me, City of London, saying, I mean, if you can't turn this round, firms are going to start leaving. And that's why we did this massive investment in public transport. It's interesting because when I was leader of the GLC, the City of London financial institutions were all old Etonians and Oxford graduates, and they all went out and had a boozy lunch and didn't do much work in the afternoon. And they refused ever to meet me. They had nothing. They thought I was a dangerous Marxist agent or something. But then when I was running for mayor, virtually the first thing that happened was the City Corporation came to see me and said, we want to work together, not repeat the mistake we made last time. And we did.
What about the Inner London Education Authority? I don't know how many people remember that, but it was focusing on education in central London. What was lost when it went, and the implications of education and knife crime?
Well, the old Inner London Education Authority goes back to 1889, when the London County Council was set up. And when the London County Council was expanded to become the Greater London Council, the Tory government didn't want to take over the schools from Bromley and Croydon and put them in, so it left the old LCC Education Authority and called it the Inner London Education Authority. And it was brilliant. It was filled with people who'd come into politics to actually provide a better education, and we spent a lot of money actually doing that and giving kids a real opportunity. The tragedy is this government over the last 9 years has made massive cuts in education. My wife's a teacher. She spends half her day on paperwork. Now, some of that's marking, but an awful lot of it's all this nonsense. The government wants details and data. If I think back to the teachers that taught me, they spent all day just teaching, not paperwork. The other thing that I think has become appalling, I went to an ordinary working class school just south of Brixton with 2,000 boys. In the 6 years I was there, at least one boy was expelled. It might have been two. Now what you've got is schools all over the place aren't just expelling kids for violence or crime. They're expelling them or pushing them to leave because they don't want them to stay because they're not doing terribly well in the exams, and it's going to bring down their rating on the exam things. Now, this is outrageous. You're pushing kids out of school, they're hanging around on the streets, they get caught up in gangs, they get caught up in knife crime. We should be saying, schools, you keep the kids in there, you concentrate on them and you help them. But to do that, we've got to restore a decent level of funding for education. I mean, before my wife became a teacher, we'd be watching the telly to 11 or 12. Now she goes to bed sometime between 8:30 and 9. She's knackered.
You wrote a book back in the 1980s called If Voting Changed Anything, They'd Abolish It. Now, obviously you want people to vote, but why did you choose that title?
Well, when I was a kid, there was a bridge near where my mum was going to hospital at the time. My dad drove us down to see her every Saturday. And on this bridge was that slogan. It's an anarchist slogan. If voting changed anything, they'd abolish it. And then I use that because that book is about my 5 years as leader of the GLC. And effectively, Thatcher proved that true. We elected a GLC leadership that did really change things. Thatcher was terrified, so she abolished it. Literally, they will do anything to prevent socialists coming to power. Look at the smears being levelled at Bernie Sanders in the last American campaign to be the Democratic candidate for president. It was appalling. Look what when President Roosevelt in 1933, having just been elected, introduced benefits for the unemployed, the Republicans are screaming it's the first step to communism. Oh, it's bonkers.
OK, well, let's get on to Boris. He took over from you...
2008.
He is remembered quite fondly for his bikes, isn't he?
Yeah, but he just inherited the scheme. The only difference he made is he cancelled the bikes I was going to buy and bought much more expensive ones. And frankly, I think that was a bit nonsense. But apart from that, but you see, the other thing is, broadly, it's at the centre of London where the business community is. For me, bringing that bike scheme, you started at the centre, but you extended it to cover the whole of London. He never did that.
What about the bridge?
His bridge, well... I remember John Lumley coming to see me when I was there saying they want to build this green bridge that people just, you know, meet up and chat on and so on. And I said, that's fine. She never asked me for any money for it, though. And then, I mean, they asked Boris for money, put the money up, and it just never got built. God knows whether. It was about 40 million disappeared.
Don't you think London needs something a bit like that, though? We've got all these bridges, and they're all rather sort of functional, you know. They're not, yeah. They're just getting from one side to the other, not for hanging around.
But if it can be done at a reasonable price, yes. But, I mean, the other thing was, before I lost to Boris, I was planning to build a new bridge over the East End, so that, at the moment, so many cars coming in from Essex go virtually into the centre of London, under the tunnel or over a bridge and then out to South East London. It would be much better to avoid all that by letting them cross the River Thames much farther to the east. Boris scrapped that. It was about a dozen major transport projects I had. They're all mentioned in my autobiography. And Boris stopped all of them. The only one he didn't cancel was the bikes.
You've got a massive hub for aviation here, Heathrow particularly. What's Boris's record?
Well, Boris was always promising, because he represented a constituency who would be affected by it, that he'd lie down in front of the bulldozer. He's a bit more equivocal now, because I think most Tory MPs want a big expansion at Heathrow. The trouble is, that will be devastating. I mean, back in 1946, when the Labour government decided to have our airport at Heathrow, there weren't a lot of people living around there. It was on the outskirts of London. If anyone could have foreseen what it's going to be like now, they would have put it much farther out. And therefore, to put another... I mean, if you want to expand our air capacity, you should look at the other surrounding airports and so on.
Like, Stansted, Gatwick.
Yeah, like those. Or build another one out there. But you don't really want... the pollution those planes cause. And there's, a million people living around there now.
So if you had to give us your review of Boris's time as Mayor of London, this is what he's achieved.
He introduced the bike scheme I started. The only other thing he did in his 8 years, he built the cable car to nowhere, which was a disaster. I'd been approached, say, can we have a cable car? And we looked at it, and it's financially disastrous, so I said no. Then they get Boris to build it, and basically no one uses it. And the only other thing he did, he supported the building of a revolving restaurant in the Olympic site. That's it for 8 years. I mean, the thing that struck me about Boris, I don't actually think he's a politician. I think he wants to be a celebrity, to be famous, have women chasing him and all of that. I found that 8 years of my life was the best time I ever had in work. We could do so much. It was 24/7. But all I ever saw Boris doing was using it to promote himself. And I think Boris should have gone into show business, not politics.
What was his biggest disaster in London, do you think?
I can't think of a disaster. If you want to define disaster, the fact he didn't really do anything for 8 years. And now we've got a huge housing problem. Just as I, about a month before I lost the election to Boris, a new law came into power that I'd asked Blair to pass, giving the mayor power over housing, because I hadn't had any of that. I'd got the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, to give me £5 billion to start building council housing. Boris didn't do it. I mean, I would have started that programme. And, that's our problem. Boris has left Sadiq Khan, the current mayor, with an appalling inheritance.
So are you saying that Boris had £5 billion to build council houses with, public housing, that he just decided he was going to turn his back on?
Yes, he did. I mean, literally, it's appalling. Because, as I say, that's one of the biggest problems we've got in London now. Air pollution, lack of housing that's affordable.
The London media, do they do a good job, do you think, on reporting the way that London's governed and the way that you and Boris have made a different kind of job of it?
Back in those days, I was leader of the GLC. Newspapers had lots more staff than they do now. If a reporter turned up to interview me, they'd obviously have spent a day researching and getting ready the questions and things like that. Now it's just, you know, one guy turns up, the camera over his back, and asks a few questions and goes. But also the real problem we got is that the Evening Standard, when I first became mayor, was run by Max Hastings. It was really brilliant. He was completely fair and honest editor. I had to read it every day because there was real news in it. And then it was taken over by Veronica Wadley, who just used it as an advertising magazine for the Tory party. And half the readership dropped away during her years running it. And it was all filled with lies and smears. I mean, 6 months of headlines saying I was corrupt in the run-up to the 2008 election. And it, literally, Boris, as soon as he got elected, appointed a committee of Tory council leaders to investigate it. After 10 weeks they came back and said, no, nothing.
What about the BBC though? Because they're supposed to do a bit of a better job. We pay for them. They're supposed to be public servants.
They're not bad, but they do have a bias. I mean, a week before the 2012 election, Question Time was going to have a debate between me and Boris, the Lib Dem and the Green candidate. And Boris Linton Crosby, his campaign manager, Boris was doing badly in all the debates, so he asked the BBC to scrap it, and they did. They then lied, saying, well, we decided to scrap it because it's only about London, people wouldn't be interested. We pointed out that the one 4 years earlier had been the best audience figures for Question Time in the whole year. And I also noticed that they seem to make much more. I mean, they headline Labour's got an anti-Semitism problem. If you look at ITV, it's very seldom. It's third or fourth item. And when the Evening Standard started all these allegations, ICE corrupt, the BBC London Region programme just reported them all and reported them all. But they hadn't bothered to check was any evidence of it. ITV's London programme, that they were much more cautious about it. So I think there is a sort of an establishment bias in the BBC. It's not a bad thing, but, you know, it's not perfect either.
What about Brexit? This is gripping the country. I think most people, if we had a referendum on whether we want it all over and done with as soon as possible, everyone would vote yes.
Well, all the polls suggest it'd be about 54% remain and 46% believe. And what's changed public opinion isn't politicians, but it's all the business communities have come out and said this is going to be a real problem. And you see, in the referendum, everyone was making guesses about what will happen if we stay, what will happen if we leave. But they can only be guesses because no country's ever walked away from a trade bloc of this size. It's the largest economy in the world. So you need to look at the past. In 1958, the year that the common market was first set up, and we decided not to join, in that year, 16% of Germany's imports came from Britain. Then we stayed out for nearly a decade and a half. That was halved to just 8% in 1972. Then we joined. 7 years later, it's 18%. I mean, it's just catastrophic. Given half our exports go to the European Union, if something like that happens again, that means a quarter of our exports go.
You don't agree with Brexit, but the country voted for it.
Yeah, because they were lied to. They were told if we leave...
Only on one side?
No. I mean, they were told if we leave, we can, what is it, 350 million a week more for NHS and all of that.
I mean, can the country cope with, because many people talk about immigration as one of the main reasons for it, with 300,000 extra people every year coming into the UK?
Yeah, but 70% of the people who come here come with a university degree, so that's a boost to the economy. Loads of...
But they displace other people, don't they?
No, they don't displace other people. The people that come here to be nurses and teachers are filling gaps and vacancies because our education system is, I think, in a disastrous state. We're not ensuring that more of our kids get the skills necessary to become a nurse, a teacher or a doctor. And until we do, I mean, if you stop immigrants coming here to do those jobs, more people are going to die.
Well, talking of people dying, a lot of people who voted for Brexit are now dying. Mm. So the longer we leave it, the less those people will be listened to.
All the polls show that if it's another vote, we would vote to remain. I mean, the trouble is, putting it off for 5 years, I mean, the impact on the economy is going to be disastrous. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of jobs will be lost.
Do you take no recognition whatsoever of people that say there's too much immigration then? I mean, there were stories recently saying that are there any English people left in London?
Well, London has the most diverse population in most likely the whole of Europe, but it is the only city that matches American levels of productivity and competitiveness, because the immigrants who've come here, as I say, 70% come with a degree. They come here to work. They don't come here just to, you know, draw benefits or something like that. Throughout our history, the right-wing media have pandered to xenophobia. Back into 1906, the Daily Mail headline was "Jews bring crime and disease to Britain," and right up until the Second World War, anti-Semitism was the big scare. You know, all these Jews are coming here from Eastern Europe and Russia and all that. Then it was the Caribbeans coming here, and now, I mean, it's basically, oh, it's the Muslims coming and the East Europeans. It helps sell the paper, but it stirs up fear and hatred.
You know what bothered about a United States of Europe then? Because although Britain is actually out of this at the moment, there's now the beginnings of a European army. A United States of Europe, anyway, is a phrase that's been used by both Macron and Merkel.
Yeah, but they aren't going to get that through, because there's a lot of European governments, like Hungary, would veto that. And don't forget, the way the EU works is each of the 28 countries has a veto on the decisions taken. And I mean, the simple fact is, I mean, that, you know, it's just not going to get through. The chance that all 28 countries would agree to actually abolish their own powers is just never going to happen.
So Tony Benn was wrong about Brussels. He said it's basically a rich man's businessman's club.
No, I mean, the rich man businessman's club is here in the city of London. That dominates the whole of Europe, in a lot of the whole world.
Well,
blame the Europeans, blame our financial sector.
Is there anything we could do about the money system, though? Because a lot of people point to this as really backed by nothing nowadays, and also going increasingly electronic. We depend far too much on money. Although it was created originally to serve humanity, money is now, you know, people are becoming slaves to money.
You've got to regulate the financial sector. Thatcher.
Okay, so what would you do, Ken?
Well, the first thing you do is make them pay their fair share of tax. This government claims that there's only £20 billion a year of tax avoidance and evasion. Some economists put it £120 billion a year. I saw one economist suggest it might even be £150 billion. So if you can stop all this tax dodging, you don't have to increase taxes, but you'd have a vast influx of new money to rebuild our NHS, our schools, you know, care of the elderly and things like that. And so that's what we've got. The financial sector has become perfect at tax dodging. It's become their greatest talent. And the whole system is just manipulated for them. They're all fabulously wealthy. I mean, you actually look back. Bankers now are earning even more than they did at the time of the banking crisis. Both Gordon Brown's Labour government and then Cameron's propped up the banking system by creating £350 billion of money to prop the system up. Well, if we can do that for the banks, why can't we do it for all the other things that we want, like, you know, house building and education? But also, the average person, their wages are no better in real terms than they were back in 2008. But the bankers are still getting vast increases in their money. This is a profoundly unfair system.
Are we ever going to see a Labour leader, do you think, maybe a Prime Minister, that will deal with this?
Well, that's why there's going to be everything done possible to stop Jeremy becoming Prime Minister, because Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell and myself, we've all been arguing this for decades, you know. Now it looks as though we're on the verge of having a government that will crack down on all the tax dodging.
Well, a lot of the polls are actually saying the opposite. They're saying that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't really stand much of a chance at the moment because of all the shilly-shallying over Brexit. If he'd been clear about what he wanted, he may actually win a general election, but now he looks like he won't. And also, remember, many of the poorest areas of the country were some of the areas that voted Brexit.
Yeah, and that was the problem Jeremy inherited. Jeremy respects the referendum, and also half of Labour's constituencies had voted to leave, and so he spent 3 years holding the party together. I think we're on the verge of coming out saying we have to remain. And we have to have another referendum. And it's taken a long time to get there, but I think that's not the site. If we have an election in the autumn, we'll be clearly arguing to remain.
As the former Mayor of London twice, Ken Livingstone, the former leader of the Greater London Council back in the 1980s, speaking to me earlier this week from his home in Willesden. Now, Fabian Breckles, what do you make of... I mean, it's lots to talk about there, but what about the last thing that Ken said was about this whole idea of having a second referendum? It does look as if now Labour is pretty much saying that.
It's essential that we do say that. I mean, I know I was at a fundraising dinner last week with Emily Thornby, and she was saying that, you know, we've got, you know, key ally of Jeremy Corbyn. She was saying we've got to come out for Remain, we've got to back a second referendum. It's essential. Everybody was lied to. Both sides ran a shocking campaign. We now know a lot more about what the consequences of leaving or not leaving are going to be.
Well, what are they? Let's get that on the record, because there's all sorts of competing. As Ken there said, no one's ever done this before. So
no
how
one's ever
can
done
we
this.
Know it? How can we know what's going to happen?
Well, just look at us coming out of the, you know, largest trading bloc in the country. Think about what that's going to do to whistle industries like aerospace and stuff like that. It's potentially ruinous for ordinary people and ordinary people's jobs.
What about, Martin, what about the idea that Brexit might actually rejuvenate some British manufacturing? Because if there's tariffs on stuff coming in, then, you know, maybe there'll be more things having to be made here in Britain.
Well, what we're being told by the Tory leadership contenders is that we won't put tariffs on stuff coming in. What we're going to find is there's tariffs on our stuff going out.
Yep.
What's going to happen is what the French are not going to put up with what they call social dumping. They're not going to allow a rump England, because of course there's a possibility of the break of the UK coming out of this, to be an export machine to break up the European Union single market. And the only way they can stop that is by putting tariffs on our stuff and basically freezing us out of the market. So you don't want to be in the union. You don't have to be in the union. We're not going to work
this
with
this whole business of Brexit came up, and whether to have another referendum or not at Prime Minister's Questions this week, brought up by the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
We made it very clear, Mr. Speaker, made it very clear what the danger of no deal is, and we will do everything to prevent a no deal exit, because we know the damage it will do to jobs and living standards in this country. Mr. Speaker, this government has comprehensively failed on Brexit. Jobs at risk, inward investment has fallen off a cliff, and manufacturing at a six-year low. No deal threatens to crash the economy. The government itself says no deal would cut growth by 10%. Yet we have two leadership candidates who are threatening no deal and indeed competing with each other on the rhetoric of no deal. This government, Mr. Speaker, is now an irrelevance. The two candidates to succeed her have only got fantasy plans. Since she and her successors have no answers, doesn't the Prime Minister accept the best thing to do would be to go back to the people and let them decide which way we go?
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, I've made the point now, I think, in answer to five of his questions, that if you want to ensure that this country leaves the European Union with a deal, you have to vote for a deal, which is what he and his colleagues have consistently refused to do. But there's another question for the Labour Party on this. With all this talk about no deal, the question really is, where does the Labour Party stand on Brexit? The Shadow Brexit Secretary doesn't support Brexit. The Shadow Foreign Secretary doesn't support Brexit. The Shadow Chancellor doesn't support Brexit. The Labour Deputy Leader doesn't support Brexit. Labour want to block Brexit, and that would be a betrayal of the many by the few.
Martin, now Jeremy Corbyn finally coming out as a second referendumer.
Well, he hasn't yet, actually. He said take it to the people.
That's what he's saying now.
He said take it to the people, which could be a general election.
which would not, we don't need a general election when we're polling at 18%. I think if he comes out, it's, I mean, the problem is some of the people who are putting pressure on him, like Len McCluskey and others, you know, putting their foot on his throat. If they get off him and let him actually do the job that he's been elected by the members to do, which is lead the Labour Party into victory, which is, you know, point of a Labour leader is to win an election and become Prime Minister. That's
so,
the job.
I mean, are there any other points that Ken brought up there that you want to bring up? I mean, obviously, this anti-Semitism, it was quite interesting to hear his view of that. Do you think that's finished with now? Because it just seems to keep coming back and back. Seems mainly issues raised by your very own Margaret Hodge.
Well, it's complicated. I think some people are conflating. Some people are, and I've seen on social media, people crossing a line between criticising the current Israeli government and their politics to almost saying that Israel doesn't have the right to exist, and that obviously for me that crosses a line. I was actually over there in March, went to Israel and Palestine, and it's quite clear that there are people in both countries, amongst both peoples, who want to coexist, want peace, and we need to engage with them, we need to work with them. Only last week I was at a meeting with a group called EcoPeace. They are looking to work with Jordanians, Palestinians and Israelis to address issues of water supply and energy supply in the area of the Jordan River, and that impacts on all three nations. So, and that's about bringing people together to work together for common solutions.
The trouble is, though, Fabian, sometimes the guns beat the numbers, don't they? I mean, when someone starts shooting, you've got to choose a side, otherwise you're just going to get shot in the crossfire.
Well, I mean, if you look at what's happening with Gaza, you get Hamas firing rockets into Israel, and they get an absolute barrage of missiles fired back at them, which then kills people and destroys homes. If you know that's what's going to happen, if you fire a couple of homemade missiles over the wall, you're going to get a whole tranche of stuff coming back. You know, maybe they should rethink. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you think about how we got the Northern Ireland peace agreement, the Good Friday Agreement. That was started by John Major, completed by Momo Olam and Tony Blair. That was bringing both sides together and forming a peace deal. And so far, Brexit puts a risk at it, because if there's a hard border between the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland, that could cause all kinds of problems there. But thus far, it's worked. Thus far, there's been peace and stability.
Martin, Ken Livingstone there put a pretty convincing case, saying that actually what he was doing was talking about historical fact. Where do you draw the line between anti-Semitism and criticism of the Israeli
state? I think you can't say that people who say that Israel, my position is they should be within the borders of 1948, which were the agreed borders, and everything since then has been land grabbing. And we went to war with Serbia. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, and I reluctantly supported the NATO intervention.
Can we talk about anti-Semitism and Israel, please?
But you've got to compare Israel to other countries. If it's going to be a country at the United Nations with recognised as a country...
I mean, Ken Livingstone said Hitler supported Zionism, and I made the point, well, hang on a minute, you know, he's not actually supporting Zionism, necessarily. Actually, a lot of the papers misquoted him, in fact, all around the world, as saying Hitler was a Zionist. And that was a deliberate misquote, but what he actually said was Hitler supported Zionism. Hitler did a deal. That doesn't necessarily mean he supported it, does he?
You need to see the Holocaust Museum actually outside Jerusalem to actually see what really happened. That's horrific. That is a sort of numbing experience.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I used to live in Poland, and I went to Auschwitz and Majdanek, where it actually happened. It didn't happen in Israel, of course. It happened in Poland, most of this stuff. And, of course, most of the Jewish leadership are originally born in Poland, like Netanyahu. Now, you've got to compare Israel to other comparable conflicts. It's not different from Northern Ireland. It's not different from Kashmir. It's not different from Serbia. Now, what happened in Serbia, when Serbia tried to aggress Kosovo, and Kosovo had been part of Serbia historically, but the population didn't want to be part of Serbia any longer. NATO went to war with Serbia. We had a 78-day bombing campaign which killed over 10,000 civilians.
Okay, but also this week, Jeremy Hunt...
Was that anti-Serbianism?
Jeremy Hunt has been accused...
Was that just politics?
Jeremy Hunt has accused Jeremy Corbyn of deeply held prejudices against Jews this week in a wide-ranging interview with Jewish News. Foreign Secretary rounds on the Labour leader and says stopping Iran getting nuclear weapons is his top Middle East policy. But he also, from apparently Auschwitz itself, is accusing Corbyn of being anti-Semitic again. This is Jeremy Hunt this week.
Well, that's absolutely disgusting. And I've heard various Jewish people on the radio today saying using the Holocaust in that way to attack somebody like Corbyn, who's got an absolutely excellent record on combating racism of all kinds, is basically disgusting, frankly. And the Jewish Voice for Labour, Landsman, who's now head of Momentum, he's attacking Jewish Voice for Labour because he's saying they're not representative of the Jewish community and they're not real Jews. Now, we are being destabilised here by the Israeli embassy. We got the sting operation that was carried out by Al Jazeera, where the Mossad officer said we've got £1 million to spend inside the Labour Party to get the results we want. Now, in actual fact, in the 1940s, we were at war with the people who are now running Israel. They were killing British soldiers. Was it anti-Semitic to point that out?
Actually, it's a different generation.
No, it's not a different generation.
Fabian, what do you make about these comments from Jeremy Hunt here, saying Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite? They're saying it from Auschwitz, apparently. I mean, I think
it's outrageous. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is. I think he has a good record of campaigning against racism of all kinds.
I mean, to be fair, most of the coverage is saying things like Jeremy Hunt is slammed after using Auschwitz visit to imply Corbyn could be the next Hitler. That is
absolutely disgusting. And I actually think, given what happened at Auschwitz was so horrible and so evil, and that so many millions of people died in these extermination camps, for anybody to dare to use an extermination camp, basically a mass grave, for political point scoring is disgusting.
What did Hunt actually say? Let's have a look. Well, he said, when I went to Auschwitz, I rather complacently said to myself, thank goodness we don't have to worry about that kind of thing happening in the UK. And now I find myself faced with the leader of the Labour Party who has opened the door to anti-Semitism in a way that is truly frightening.
Well, that I think that Jeremy Hunt speaking like that is truly shocking, and it's a good job that he isn't going to end up as Prime Minister, but he is the Foreign Secretary. And of course, the Iranians haven't got nuclear weapons. And before the Tory Party people vote on whether we're going to have which of them is going to be Prime Minister, they may both of them have to decide whether we're going to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy. And of course, we're not really happy about that in this country. And if that's what the choice we're given, we're actually going to oppose it. And the Israeli government won't like that, and will be accused of being anti-Semitic.
Okay, finally, any other things from Ken Livingstone you want to bring up that you heard there, either of you? I mean, housing, for example, is a massive, massive issue in London. You know, these £1 million houses, as he said, there's so many people having to just, literally, they can't afford to live in London at all, having to move out.
Well, our housing
target... They call it social cleansing, I think.
Yeah, well, our housing target when we got elected as administration in 2016 was 2,000 houses a year, 800 affordable. We're on target. We are doing, you know, so
we heard the figure
there. In Bristol, we're building the houses.
Yeah. Well, we heard the figure in London of £5 billion being put aside for social housing of whatever sort. I mean, this is probably going to be housing associations and council housing that Boris then turned his back on. I do wonder if Boris is being lobbied by the house builders, and of course, if there's loads of social housing starts appearing, then potentially, Martin, rents might start falling in London.
Yeah, but when they started building council housing in the 1940s in Putney, for example, but Morrison turned round to the local Tory MP and said, "We're building you out. We're building you out here. We were building you out."
What do you mean by that?
Because they moved a load of people from the East End to Putney and put them in new housing. But these are Labour voters because the Labour Party have given them a house. So that there's a policy. He doesn't need to be lobbied by the.
Because this is the side effect of all this upping of the house prices in London. Is actually the Labour voters are having to move
out
of the
right.
city.
But
that's
also,
right.
also, what's happening is you know, austerity is a political choice, and you know, because the deficit's actually gone up, it hasn't gone down, we haven't paid anything off. Mm-hmm. You know, poverty, we now have obscene levels of poverty, we have in-work poverty, that's a deliberate political choice. People are actually going to work, working flat out, and can't pay the bills, they can't make ends meet. We've got to deal with that, and that's got to be, you know, Labour's top priority.
Okay, well, we're just going to go quickly over to the Sky News Centre.
...be part of the rebel group, and has this message for Theresa May's successor.
I hope that whoever is the next Prime Minister will work flat out from day one to get a good deal and assemble a majority for it in the House of Commons.